From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We thought they didn't really like each other and seemed to be polar opposites, but what to make of the now completely open warfare between President Trump and James Comey, the FBI director Trump fired last year? In tweets this morning, President Trump called Comey an untruthful slimeball who should be prosecuted, a leaker, and a liar. And this, of course, after excerpts of Comey's forthcoming memoir were splashed all across the news last night.
The memoir is called A Higher Loyalty, and in it, Comey calls the Trump presidency a forest fire doing damage to U.S. institutions. He calls Mr. Trump unethical and untethered to the truth, and he compares him to the mob bosses that he used to prosecute. Today, ABC began airing parts of Comey's first TV interview about the book. Here's what Comey said about his first meeting with President Trump. It was right after the inauguration. Comey was warning him about allegations that had not yet surfaced.
The allegation was that he had been involved with prostitutes in a hotel in Moscow in 2013 during a visit for the Miss Universe pageant, and that the Russians had filmed the episode. And he interrupted very defensively and started talking about it. You know, do I look like a guy who needs hookers?
And believe me, we've been trying to come up with language to be able to talk about these conversations for you, as we're going to in just a couple minutes. But this all comes as Trump weighs whether to fire FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller or fire off missiles in response to an apparent chemical attack in Syria. Let us convene our Friday Politics Roundtable. This week, Abby Phillip, White House correspondent for CNN. Hi, Abby.
Hi. And Thanks for having me.
And wonderful to see you or hear you. And Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
And Abby, what's the mood last night and today at the White House?
Well, I would say there's a fair amount of anger and exasperation from the president's aides, but that's mostly, I think, channeling the president himself. Many of them are frustrated by Comey's decision not just to attack Trump in those terms as a liar and someone who doesn't care about American democracy, but also in very deeply personal terms, criticizing his appearance and talking about his marriage with Melania Trump. But there's also, I think, a kind of tinge of fear a little bit among White House aides right now, a fear of the unknown, a fear of how the president is going to react to all of this. He is here in Washington for the next couple of days. He canceled a trip to Peru for the Summit of the Americas, where he would have otherwise been this weekend. And he's here. There is Syria on the back burner, but otherwise he has plenty of time to tweet and to vent and to fume about this. That interview is going to happen with ABC on Sunday night. There's a lot of time on the president's hands, and I think there's a sense among White House aides that they don't know how he's going to react and whether he's going to think that the plans that they've set in motion to push back on Comey are sufficient to defend him from these accusations.
Domenico, I wonder if you think the book is damaging to Donald Trump politically and who people are likely to believe, Donald Trump or James Comey, who in his book questions his own decision to break FBI protocol and announced that he was going to reopen the Hillary Clinton email investigation 2 weeks before the November 2016 election. He writes he was thinking about that because he thought Hillary Clinton would win, which makes you wonder why he was talking about who would win the election when he should have been thinking about legalities. What do you say?
Well, for somebody who tries to hew as closely to protocol and standards as James Comey likes to say he does, he certainly didn't in that case. You know, he's not supposed to be trying to make a calculation as to who wins the election. I think he was trying to cover himself. He's trying to say, well, he was as tough as he possibly could be on the president with Hillary Clinton if something were to come out within Congress, with the oversight that would have taken place toward Hillary Clinton, that they wouldn't have been able to say, "Oh, James Comey covered something up."
Well, so that was the point, right? He was feeling that, oh my gosh, if I don't announce it because I think she's going to win, and if I don't announce this investigation, people are going to think I held it back.
Right. So now I don't think anything is going to move the polling needle, if that's what we're looking at. You know, the Republican base that loves Donald Trump is pretty solid. You know, one Republican campaign manager, I think I've said before, called it during the primaries made of titanium. And that's probably the case here. But, you know, this president's clearly been frustrated and rattled by this, as Abby is talking about. And the fact is, this president is also trying to make big worldwide decisions right now. When you think about this potential strike in Syria, while he's the maddest he's ever been, as NPR's Mara Liasson has reported.
Yeah. Well, and Democrats who have been angry at Comey for releasing the Clinton emails and not announcing at the same time that there was an ongoing investigation into possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. They are may not be swayed by the fact that he's come out with this book that's so damning of the president. But let's listen to, you know, some more of what is hitting people. According to those who have read the book, in it, Comey says that during a briefing with intelligence agency heads about the Russian election interference, Trump and his team were utterly unconcerned about it and only sought to spin it.
They actually started talking about drafting a press release with us still sitting there. And the reason that was so striking to me is that that's just not done.
Abby, there's a lot of that in the book. It's just not done.
Yeah, the Comey here in this example, kind of referring back to what he's characterizing as the president's undermining of institutions and norms around law enforcement and around the intelligence community more generally. We talked to Kellyanne Conway at the White House this morning a little bit about this, and she pushed back by suggesting that this newly elected president would not have been the one to raise these concerns about Russian meddling, that that Comey and the people briefing the president should have said more about the impact on the election and advising in advising the president on what to do about it. That's kind of the White House's argument, that it wasn't their role to raise those concerns and that the president had just been elected. But at the same time, we also know from the president's own words that he really doesn't view the Russian meddling as an attack on American democracy. He rarely talks about it in those terms. He almost never talks about Russia being culpable for it. So it kind of rings true, Comey's telling of it, in the sense that President Trump has always been resistant to this narrative. He thinks it undermines his own legitimacy, and he's been less concerned about the broader view of Russian meddling.
That is not new. That's not new. But yeah. And Domenico, this is also not new. The allegations of Trump in a hotel room in Moscow in 2013 watching prostitutes. Now, NPR has decided not to use the language that's being used everywhere about what he was apparently watching them doing, you know, what most would consider a kind of a tawdry act. And Comey says in the book that Trump said to him when he called him in to say, can you please knock this down, this allegation, that Trump said something like, I'm a germaphobe, but I would never do that. You know, some people are saying, why would Comey put those details in, you know, what might be a serious look at the presidency and where we are in this moment? Why would he do that? On the other hand, others are saying it might be telling about the president that that would be his response and not something like, I would never be in a hotel room with prostitutes. Your take on what has really taken over the conversation about this book?
Well, I mean, okay, just addressing that in particular, you know, the president himself has come out publicly and said that he's a germaphobe, so he would never be doing that. You know, he did that in a press conference.
Right.
He said it. So he didn't identify the act as James Comey does in the book. And James Comey, for him to go and talk about that, he's not dumb. He knows that that is going to get a ton of attention and that people are going to be paying attention to this clip that's going around with him talking about it. Now, there, I will say, as a former English teacher, there's something called extraneous detail, right? Like, you don't just write details in something unless it makes a broader point. And it's not so much that detail, but things like his tie was extra long, his hands were smaller than mine, right, but not as small as I thought they'd be. Those are kind of I don't know what to say about it, but as an editor, I probably would have raised the question and said, does this need to be in here?
Just real quick, then, in the New York Times book review, they point to it as that's who Comey is. He's an observer. He's an FBI agent.
Yeah, and also remember when he wrote his testimony to Congress, there was the whole detail about the grandfather clock in the Oval Office. And these were details that at the time in that context became part of the riveting storytelling narrative that helped land Comey this book deal in the first place. So it seems to me that maybe he was trying to recreate that. But I think also the issue with this anecdote that has really irritated a lot of people at the White House was that he then goes on to talk about how the president brought up Melania Trump and saying that he wanted Comey to disprove this allegation so that his wife didn't think it was true. And then Comey observes, what kind of marriage does the president have with his wife that she would even have a remote view that something like this could be true? Those kinds of details irritate the president because they start to encroach upon something that seems irrelevant to all of these other things, which is what kind of marriage does he have with Melania Trump?
Also, it sounds like Comey is shocked that gambling is going on in the casino.
Look what happened.
Lisa, lots that we didn't get to talk about. including about Syria, just very briefly. Both of you, where do we stand right now on Syria? And we have like 30 seconds left for this.
I'll just say that it seems very much that there's a wait and see moment happening. They want more evidence that this is real and rock solid so that they don't inadvertently get into a military dispute with both Russia and Iran.
Over whether they're Syrian treading launch chemical.
They're treading more carefully than they were a few days ago.
Domenico?
Yeah, no, I think that we're all sort of sitting around and waiting. We're waiting to see, like the world is, whether or not the U.S. is going to take some kind of action. The president has teased it and he's almost set the bar where if he doesn't, he seems to have backed down.
Well, you know what we're also doing is we're talking about that book. And I'm sorry that we didn't get more on Syria. Abby Phillip, Domenico Montanaro, thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you. The Boston Marathon is 3 days away. Dina Castor is one of the top distance runners in American history. She's going to be running Boston on Monday. At the age of 45, Castor holds the American record for women in the marathon. In 2004, she won the bronze medal in the Olympics in Athens. But setting records and winning that medal took more than brutal physical training. Castor had to change the way she approached the sport mentally. She writes about this in her new book called Let Your Mind Run, a memoir of thinking my way to victory. She spoke to Here and Now's Alex Ashlock.
I started running when I was 11 years old and stumbled on it after failing miserably at so many other sports. I played soccer on my dad's soccer team and running around the field like a swarm of bees with the other kids and finally scored a goal, but it happened to be for the other team because I didn't realize we switched directions at the halftime. We moved on to softball where it was terribly boring and I would rather make dandelion necklaces in the outfield than have anything to do with the bat and ball that's required. And furthermore, I don't have much coordination, which was very apparent after I moved into ice skating and my instructor said I was too skinny to be graceful anyway. So at the point where my parents were trying to put me in sports to boost my self-esteem, to give me people to look up to in various sports, it was crushing my self-esteem until I found running. I was let loose into the Santa Monica Mountains on the first day of practice and I never wanted to turn back. It was just this love affair of exploration and joy of the twists and turns and the rattlesnakes and the brush and the smells, aromas of licorice and sage and eucalyptus. It was just heaven from the very first day.
You had that joy in running right from the very beginning. You write in the book about feeling joy when you're out running even today. But there was also a struggle in your running because you were in some ways motivated by fear of losing.
I had a pretty good running streak when I was younger, and constantly after races, parents and coaches telling me that I was talented. And when you hear that enough, I think you subconsciously lose the connection between training and performance. And so that was never clear to me. And I ended up losing a lot more in college. And once I felt defeated and frustrated and thinking that the person with the most talent is winning and that's not me, so maybe I'm burnt out, maybe I used up all of my talent resources and thought maybe it was time to move on from the sport.
Yeah, you were going to quit.
Absolutely. And I think I just felt frustrated and defeated. And when you're running with anxiety and tension, your body's not operating at its best. So I was injury prone and in a cycle of injuries and desperately wanted to get away from it.
What brought you back to it?
Luckily, I had conversations with other coaches that knew that they hadn't seen the best of me, knew that I had a fire in me when I started college and it seemed to fade out towards the end, and that maybe I just needed a change of environment. And it landed me with a phone conversation with Coach Joe Vigil in Colorado. And in 5 minutes, he completely unraveled everything I knew about running. He never mentioned talent or winning. Everything in his vocabulary was about adaptation, training principles, living an athlete's lifestyle. With just a week prior, I thought, I've been running all my life and I want to try something new, discover a new passion. And right there, I thought, I've been running my whole life and I know nothing about what makes this sport what makes this sport. I don't know why I lose and why I win. And I set out to discover that, trying to make the best choices. So I packed my bags immediately and moved out to be with Coach Vigil, because I knew under him I could have the growth that I was seeking.
And did that also bring the joy back?
It absolutely did. I think the joy was brought back the second I felt potential build in me, that I stopped thinking that I was burnt out and defeated, to feeling like, wow, I have so much to learn and so much to grow upon.
Did your work with Coach Vigil, did that help you deal with the setbacks?
Absolutely. I think the whole point in my book, Let Your Mind Run, was trying to show that mental evolution of the past two decades of my career, how as soon as I started looking at how a shift in my thinking could shift the physical effort that I was in, instead of don't give up, I changed it to maintain contact. And when my mind was in don't give up, when that was my mantra in my head, I was just fading off this pack. And as soon as I realized I was using negative words, don't and give up, I switched it to maintain contact, because that's actually what I wanted out of my body. And by telling my body what I wanted it to do, not what I didn't want it to do, I felt a complete energy shift in my body, and I pulled forward and latched back onto the group ahead of me. So these were discoveries that were so profound. And then we moved to gratitude lists and imagery and positive affirmations and all these things that were transforming my running in such a big way, but in the end ended up transforming me and enabling me to really deal with setbacks in running a lot more easier, and also in life.
So these are life lessons in addition to being running lessons, and they could apply to ordinary runners, ordinary people who aren't Olympic medalists.
That was my intention in writing, not to write a memoir so people could learn more about me, but more of an instructional memoir so people could discover more about themselves.
That's marathoner Dina Castor speaking with our marathoner, Alex Ashlock. Castor's book, written with Michelle Hamilton, is called Let Your Mind Run, A Memoir of Thinking My Way to Victory. There's an excerpt at hereandnow.org.
Well, Lauren Zitomirsky will be running as well on Monday. They may see each other coming and going, as you will hear, because Lauren is trying to set a world record, but current course record holder Jeffrey Mutai of Kenya is not worried, because Lauren is running backwards. 26.2 miles. And yes, it is a thing with its own record. Lauren joins us from Pasadena, California. Lauren, why backwards?
So I've been raising money and awareness for epilepsy for the last 20 years. I lost my brother Brian to epilepsy before I was born. And the epilepsy community helped my dad so much during his time of need that my dad felt he wanted to give back to that community. And over the last 20 years, we've raised over $300,000 for the Epilepsy Foundation. And I had told myself that if I could qualify for the Boston Marathon, mm-hmm. that I would do something big for Boston, where I could raise as much money and awareness outside of my network as possible. And I qualified for Boston. I went on the Guinness Book of World Records website, and I stumbled upon the fastest marathon ever run backwards, which is 3 hours, 43 minutes, and 39 seconds, which is about an 8.5 minute per mile pace. And I said, I can do that.
That was set in 2004 by a Chinese runner, Zhu Chenjun, at the Beijing Marathon. But that's a very tender story. Your half-brother who died in his sleep after suffering seizures. You're bringing awareness to the fact that epilepsy is still a very serious condition. You now want to raise $100,000 for it. And now the running backwards, which, let's just talk about the practicality of this, because we can't stand it. We just can't stand it. Don't you ever fall and bump into things?
Well, since I made the decision to attempt this last June, I have ran just about 650 miles backwards. So at this point, I'm pretty much as much of an expert at backwards running as possible. And yes, I have fallen a couple times. I ran backwards into a tree and cut up my back. I've dealt with all sorts of ailments and injuries with my muscles. For anyone who's run backwards, they know it's really hard. It's so much harder than running forwards.
Why? Tell us about it. I'm trying to, I can't actually try it here in the studio right now because I have a bit of an injury. Talk about the differences in muscles, for instance.
So with running backwards, it's really tough on your calves, quads, glutes, and feet. And I really think it's difficult because it's just not a natural form of movement. It uses a lot more smaller muscles as opposed to bigger muscles. And, you know, we're just not used to moving in a backwards manner. So I basically had to retrain my body to do this.
Well, it must be tough on your neck, too.
Well, you know, when I'm out running by myself, I am looking behind me. So basically my head's like on a swivel. And so, yeah, it does bother my neck. But I think, you know, all the months and miles of backwards running, my neck has gotten used to it. For the Boston Marathon, I'll have a spotter with me. He'll basically be the eyes that I don't have in the back of my head. We came up with a system where he gives me audible commands, basically telling me to move right, move left. And if it looks like I'm going to fall or run into something, he can like physically grab me.
I'm good. I'm sorry. When was the last time you were in Boston in the spring? Because I'm just thinking how quickly he can yell out pothole and you can avoid it, or trolley tracks. You know, God, are you worried?
No, I'm not worried. You know, I've ran so many miles backwards, and I actually ran the last 20 miles of the LA Marathon backwards a few weeks ago as a practice long run. You know, hopefully with the Boston Marathon, I'll be with a much faster, you know, group of runners around me, and, you know, I won't have joggers or people stopping and spectators crossing the path.
You're facing the runners. I would think that would throw their run off. They're staring at your face.
Yeah, so when I run backwards in these races, yes, everybody is staring at me, which is always interesting. You know, when I'm running backwards and people are running forwards and I pass them, there's that moment where we're face to face and I get all kinds of reactions.
You're passing me and you're running backwards. Well, what will you be thinking about when you cross that finish line, which you can't really see?
You know, I'll be thinking about the 1 in 26 people that will be diagnosed with epilepsy in their lifetime. I'm trying to bring epilepsy out into the open because it is still a very, very stigmatized disorder.
Lauren Zitomirsky will tell you how to hook up with his website and what his number is so you can follow him as he runs the Boston Marathon backwards for the Epilepsy Foundation. Lauren, good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, if you want to see what this looks like, I mean, it's incredible. Go to herenow.org. We have a video there from his website. We'll also link you to the Boston Marathon website. His number, 4758, if you want to follow this. Last fall, the character Rich Uncle Pennybags from the Monopoly game showed up at the Equifax data breach hearing. Yesterday, Monopoly Man was back with monocle and bushy white mustache at the Senate hearing for acting Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Chief Mick Mulvaney. Earlier in the week, Monopoly Man switched outfits and donned a swirl of blue-green hair like a troll doll and was the Russian troll seen at Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's Senate hearings. Amanda Werner is both characters. Amanda is with the nonprofit consumer rights advocacy group Public Justice. Amanda also formerly worked in Senator Elizabeth Warren's office, whose brainchild the CFPB was. Many Republicans want to either rein it in or do away with it. Amanda, your pictures of you as Monopoly Man are hilarious, directly behind Mulvaney, adjusting your monocle. But what do you want to say?
You know, I've got a lot to say. I think one reason I've taken the approach of kind of making a spectacle of myself is to actually steal away the spotlight from these lawmakers who want to grandstand in these hearings and then not pass any meaningful legislation. So hopefully by stealing their spotlight, I'm putting more pressure on them from their constituents to actually do their jobs.
Well, you know the debate over the CFPB. Let's just talk about that. Mm-hmm. Its supporters say it's taken on big banks and shady payday lenders, but Republicans who want to at least restructure it say it's rogue, it's not funded by Congress, it's run by a single director who can't be fired by the president. Here's Mick Mulvaney being questioned by North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis.
I would expect that you came into this hearing with a heart rate of about 2, because you know damn well there's not a single thing that any one of us can do and hold you accountable for. Do you agree with that?
You can make me look bad, and that's about it.
So, Amanda, their point being they want more oversight. Your thoughts?
There actually is a part of the statute that establishes the CFPB where they can remove the director. It just has to be for cause. The Republicans in Congress like to try to act as if the CFPB is unaccountable and different from all the other regulators, when in reality, it's got the same standards that, you know, the OCC, the Fed, all of these other groups actually have to live up to.
Okay. Well, we have to move on to the Mark Zuckerberg hearing. You were there as well. You had this Russian troll outfit on, this blue and green swirly wig like a troll doll, and you were passing out Russian money.
I was just trying to buy a political ad.
Well, and this, you say it was personal for you.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, much like the Equifax data breach, my data was part of the, you know, 87 million Americans who were exposed to Cambridge Analytica in the last election. But one reason I wanted to show up specifically to Mark Zuckerberg is because he's allowed Russian trolls to run rampant on Facebook to the point where 126 million Americans were exposed to Russian propaganda during the election. Mm-hmm. You know, meanwhile, Donald Trump won the Electoral College by just 70,000 votes.
Well, you bring it to politics, and some people say this is just political. You worked for Senator Warren. Is it?
No, not at all. I actually have Trump supporters that follow me on Twitter, which is definitely interesting for me being a, you know, a transgender person. But no, I don't think it's political at all. I think it's really more about the little guys versus the big guys.
Well, that's Amanda Werner, who is the Monopoly man and the Russian troll that you see right behind the shoulders of some of these people being questioned in hearings. But how do you get into these things? You're dressed like a troll, for crying out loud. And how do you not, I mean, you do everything, I guess, legally.
Yeah. You know, I think the trick is that you have to know exactly what the rules are. You can wear, you know, outlandish clothes. You can have crazy hair. You can't wear a mask. So I just barely skirt the line. You know, technically a monocle is just a form of glasses.
Amanda, thank you. We'll keep looking for you.
Yeah, I'm not going away anytime soon.
Today is a good day for Hector Barajas. He's becoming a U.S. citizen, but the path has been a long and rocky one. He was born in Mexico, and his parents brought him to the U.S. illegally when he was young. Barajas eventually got a green card. He enlisted in the Army in 1995 and was honorably discharged in 2001. But then things took a bad turn. In 2002, he pleaded guilty to shooting at an occupied vehicle. He served 3 years in prison and then was deported. Since then, he's been trying to help other vets who are in his shoes. In Mexico, he founded the Deported Veterans Support House in Tijuana. And last year, California Governor Jerry Brown gave him a pardon. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd spoke with Hector Barajas on Skype from Tijuana as the veteran was preparing to return to the U.S. to become a citizen.
For me, it's very important. I'm very happy that I'm able to return to my daughter. So, you know, I'll see my parents when I need to without having to worry about, you know, if I can't be there for emergencies and stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, you could have, I'm sure you know this and have spent a lot of time thinking about this, taking care of the situation before it became a problem. People who serve in the military but are not citizens can apply for citizenship. Why didn't you do that at the time when you were younger, before you got into trouble?
So basically two things happened. I was under the impression that I was a citizen for a certain time. Finally, I'm not a citizen, so I did start the application process, but I didn't follow through on it. So just a lack of responsibility for my part as well.
You were young.
And then, yeah, I was young. And then the other one is also the military didn't really direct me and educate me on what needed to be done. I think they should have also at one point counseled me on citizenship and what the process was.
So I guess what you're saying is that it was a little unclear to you that even though you had a green card, you could lose it and you could be deported if you committed a serious crime, which is what happened. You pled guilty to an assault charge for firing a gun in a car. Can you tell us more about what happened?
Yeah, basically, I went to prison for 3 years. I paid my debt to society. You know, I was involved in an incident that where somebody could have been hurt. And, you know, I paid dearly for it. I got deported as well. I'm not very proud of that situation, but that was almost 15 years ago. So, you know, I believe I redeemed myself, you know, in regards to that, you know, and you know, people are always going to point it out. They might say, oh, well, you're still a criminal.
Yeah.
You know, it's to each their own, you know, as far as that opinion.
Well, it is. I mean, it is tricky territory, Hector, because there will be people listening to this interview who are thinking you fired a gun into a car. Those were the consequences, and these are the policies in place, and that's what happens. You can get deported.
My response to that is that those are the consequences. That's why I was deported, and right now the only reason I'm going back home is because of the pardon. I was pardoned for that specific crime, and I meet the criteria for citizenship.
How did you feel when you were deported and you knew that you had this record of military service? Was that dispiriting to you?
I thought that, okay, well, I'm a vet. They're going to give me a not-forsaken opportunity. I thought that maybe at some point, you know, I thought I was the only person going through this, and
you know, that they would stop the deportation. But then I found out I'm not the only one.
Mm-hmm.
We found out that there's people deported, guys that had served in combat, guys that have been drafted, you know, all kind of different people, you know. So it's like, wow.
The guys who you met and worked with in Mexico, what did they tell you they needed when they came to you?
A lot of the guys, we've been struggling with getting VA benefits, access to directly to the VA. We actually have a guy right now that is en route to San Diego. And the VA actually said that they wouldn't make a letter to accept him into a hospital. So they basically had to find a civilian hospital to accept him right now. And he's pretty much, you know, he's on life support.
So even if you've been deported, you still have full military benefits.
If you're service-connected, yes. If you're not service-connected, you're not entitled to certain benefits.
You've got another big transition coming up now. You're headed back to the United States. You're going to cross that line in San Ysidro. How are you feeling about that?
I'm very excited that I'm able to finally return back home and that, you know, I can start my life all over again, be able to reconnect with my daughter and do more from over there than, you know, we've been able to do amazing work from down in Tijuana by getting the guys their VA benefits, helping and getting guys their pardons. And I think I can do a lot more by advocating for these guys on the other side.
Hector Barajas is a veteran who was deported after serving a prison term. He's been pardoned by California Governor Jerry Brown and is now becoming a citizen. Hector, thanks for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you. Have a great day.
Well, staying with immigration issues and California Governor Jerry Brown, and in a case of strange bedfellows, President Trump tweeted congratulations to Jerry Brown yesterday. Jerry Brown is doing the right thing and sending the National Guard to the border. Thank you, Jerry. Good move for the safety of our country. Well, California Governor Brown has agreed to send some National Guard troops to the border after the Trump administration called on border states to pledge between 2,000 and 4,000 troops total. But Brown says these troops will not be participating in immigration enforcement. Ben Adler is Capitol Bureau Chief for Capitol Public Radio in California. He joins us from Sacramento. And so, Ben, what is Governor Brown saying these troops will do?
They will participate in an existing program supporting operations that target transnational criminal gangs. So we're talking, you know, the gangs, human traffickers, illegal firearm and drug smugglers, and not just along the border, but the coast and throughout the state. They will not be building a wall, the governor says. They will not be participating in immigration enforcement, and they will not be trying to stop people coming across the border in any way, shape,
right,
or form.
So remind us of the context. We have about 400 now of these troops, but again, they'll be spread around the state. The number of Border Patrol arrests in California fell to the lowest level last year since 1971. And we know Governor Brown has been pushing back on Trump's claim that there's sort of an immigration crisis.
Yeah, in the letter that he sent to the Trump administration this week to the Secretaries of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense, he says, look, here are the facts. There is no massive wave of migrants pouring into California. Overall, immigrant apprehensions on the border last year were as low as they've ever been in nearly 50 years, and 85% of the apprehensions occurred outside of California. And Brown, a former Jesuit seminarian, went on to write that he agrees with the Catholic bishops who have said that state, local, and federal officials should work collaboratively and prudently in the implementation of this deployment, ensuring that the presence of the National Guard is measured and not disruptive to community life. And so what you've got with the strange bedfellows here is, you know, the governor not automatically doing the knee-jerk political punch that one might expect the governor of this very blue state to do, but as Jerry Brown has long done, kind of taken a step back, analyzed it, and gone his own way in a way that, you know, even people criticizing the governor from the left for this decision are acknowledging that he may have threaded the needle a little bit here.
Well, let's remind ourselves, he is the only Democratic leader of the four border states asked to deploy National Guard troops. And you spoke to a Republican political consultant, Rob Stutzman, who pretty much said, I got to hand it to him. He said he's impressed because he said, to me, it seems like instead of grandstanding, as some of the left wanted him to do for political purposes against the president, he gave the president his conditions, takes the federal money, and will fight crime.
That's exactly what's going on here. And he can do that because under the part of federal law that the president is seeking to deploy these troops under, the governors retain control of each state's National Guard. It's very clear in the Constitution. So if the president wanted border help this way, short of federalizing the Guard, which I don't think he wanted to do because that also wasn't what Presidents Bush and Obama did in 2006 and 2010, this was the way he was going to get it. He was going to get it in a way that Jerry Brown is getting some federal money to bolster some existing efforts to deal with border security issues, which even some Democrats, many Democrats acknowledge do exist. The money won't be used to fight immigration and enforcement. And so I actually wonder to what extent, if any, the Border Patrol is going to get help from these National Guard members, because they're going to be focused on this mission of dealing with crime and not immigration.
Well, just remind us, we've got about a minute left here. You say instead of federalizing the border, that's illegal. To have
It's not illegal to federalize the National Guard, but then they cannot participate in law enforcement activities. And so there's some nuance there. As long as the troops are under the command of the governor, they can participate in law enforcement activities. So it's clear we see this memorandum of agreement in California that the California troops are not going to do this. I haven't had a chance to look at the other states' agreements, but it's worth checking to see what their rules of engagement are going to be.
It's a posse comitatus. You can't have military doing what law enforcement could do. Ben Adler, Capitol Bureau Chief at Capitol Public Radio in Sacramento. Fascinating chess game there. Thank you.
You're welcome.
A new documentary from IMAX and Warner Brothers follows the young panda Chen Chen as she makes her way into the wild.
One of these pampered cubs is about to be chosen for the mission of a lifetime. Her objective? Help expand the wild panda population.
The film tells the story of China's beloved pandas, and along with Chen Chen and other stars from the animal world, we meet Ben Killam, who's a wildlife biologist from New Hampshire. He's been raising orphaned black bears for more than 25 years, and the Chinese thought that he could help with their panda population. Ben, welcome to Here and Now, and clearly you've learned a lot about black bears over the years, and it caught the attention of these Chinese researchers. Tell us more about your method of working with the giant panda.
I remember when we got our first two pandas, and the pandas are kept in zoo-like conditions, and the keepers were generally afraid of pandas. And the keepers immediately observed and complained that the pandas liked Jake better than they liked them. And we had to explain to them that, first of all, the Chinese hadn't had pets until recently, and we had to explain to them that they had to treat the panda like it was a sentient being, like it was another person.
What does that really? Even though it's a big bear?
Yeah, and not like an object.
But what does that mean in practicality?
In practicality, it means that if you've got a dog at home and it's your pet, and somebody comes into your house who doesn't like dogs, your dog's not going to like them either.
Yeah, but that's a domesticated animal. I mean, how do you mean?
It has nothing to do with it. The commonality between all species of mammals is extremely close. And if you study behavior, you can see these commonalities. And it came right to the surface with his first cubs. You know, they didn't like or trust the keepers because the keepers were treating them like objects.
So
as soon as the keepers recognized and understood what we were telling them, the pandas started interacting with them and liking them.
So this was a major lesson for the Chinese. And what did they do differently? I mean, how did they start treating them as sentient beings?
Well, all of a sudden, they had empathy for them, and they were seeing them as something other than just this object in a cage. You know, the importance of that is huge. And again, you can see it with your household dog because its behavior towards somebody who doesn't like dogs is very, very similar.
Was your physical interaction with the pandas similar to what it is with the black bears in New Hampshire? Because it seems like, you know, you're not the least bit afraid to touch them or them touch you, have them touch you.
Yeah, it was very similar. And we have I had a rule in New Hampshire, and we maintain it in China, is that we don't inflict our behavior on the bear. If the bears want to play with us, we respond. But we don't go pat them on the head and incite them to wrestle or play or do any of those things.
So one thing was to find a common denominator between the black bear of New Hampshire and the giant panda of China, where you were working. What is the commonality between them?
They're both bears. The giant panda is a much earlier form of bear, around 13 million years old. The black bear is around 6 million years old, so they came off the evolutionary tree at different stages.
And they both need a lot of mothering, and that's where you come in.
Yeah, the juvenile period for both of them is 18 months to 2 years. My examples come from my experience with black bears, and I have a bear named Squirty who's been in both of the books that I've written, who came to me as a 3-pound cub that was 7 weeks old. She's now 22 years old with her 11th litter of cubs. She had no experience with her mother outside of the den. So to give her that experience, I would take her for walks. She instinctively would follow me. But if she wasn't following me, she wouldn't leave a 2-acre territory. And on those walks up to 9 hours at a time, she had an experience of her natural environment, of other bears, of potential predators like coyotes. And then I would return her safely to the remote enclosure. She felt obligated to follow me until she reached 18 months old, which was the normal time of dispersal, at which time her behavior changed and she was ready to be on her own.
So give me an example of how your experience with Squirty in New Hampshire translated to your experience with one of the giant pandas in China.
Well, the primary panda has been released once and needed to be rescued because she had an interaction with another animal, and her name is Chen Chen, and it's what the
movie's about. Chen Chen.
The IMAX movie is about Chen Chen's life. She will be released probably in June this year. She just had her first estrus, so she'll be a full-blown adult panda by the time she goes out. But she's very independent. She's very capable of taking care of herself, and we will be able to track her closely and interact with her in the wild.
You going to go over there in June for her farewell?
I hope to. I had a double knee replacement, so. But they're doing very well, and I should be back climbing around mountains pretty soon.
The knees are doing very well, and you are too.
Yep.
Nice to talk to you. Ben Killam, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Ben Killam of the Killam Bear Center in Lyme, New Hampshire. He's one of the human stars in the new IMAX documentary, Pandas. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.